On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Wisconsin is a battleground state in the 2020 election. That's been well established. Lots of eyes on us. Wisconsin's spring general election will be held Tuesday, April 7th. The primary is Tuesday, February 18th to whittle down the candidates in advance of the general. We're asking about 2020 election preparations, security. Join in any point. What questions do you have about voting? Do you plan to vote in the upcoming elections for state Supreme Court, the 7th Congressional District, or one of your local races? What elections will be bringing you out to the ballot box? We're at 800-642-1234. Megan Wolf is administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Megan, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the first elections of the year are a little over a month away and counting, Tuesday, February 18th. What will voters be deciding on that day?
So actually, tomorrow is the date for the commission to certify candidates at the state level for the ballot. And so we'll find out if we'll have a primary on February 18th for a statewide contest, and then who will be on the ballot for the February 7th election as well. And so the same thing is happening at the local level right now, too. So the February primary and the April election are typically our nonpartisan spring elections. And so this means that your state and local contests that are nonpartisan, things like judgeships or maybe some of your local offices, will be on the ballot. But like I said, tomorrow, the commission will be certifying those candidates at the state level. And once the candidates have been certified, the local election officials will start preparing ballots, and you'll be able to check your sample ballot to see exactly what will be on your ballot. And you can do that by visiting myvote.wi.gov, and there you'll see your sample ballot. And I should also note that if you're in the 7th Congressional District, so if you're in the northern part of the state, you're also going to have an election and a primary for the vacancy in the 7th Congressional District as well.
Vacated by Congressman Sean Duffy, who retired about 3 months ago.
Correct. Yep.
So judicial races, as you said, nonpartisan, the ballots won't say whether a candidate is Republican or Democrat like other elections. How do primaries work in these elections?
Sure. So if there are more people running, have asked to be on the ballot for that seat, then there are, so let's say, for example, for a judgeship, for Supreme Court, there's one seat. And so if there are more than two candidates that are running, then you're going to have a primary. So we'll see again after tomorrow when the commission takes a look at those nomination papers that are filed by the candidates to make sure everybody has sufficient signatures in order to get on the ballot. Then we'll see for sure if there is going to be a primary. It's looking like right now there is. There were three candidates that filed nomination papers for Supreme Court. And again, tomorrow the commission just certifies those to make sure that they have adequate signatures to get on the ballot.
And when you certify, what is that process like? How do you ensure that there are enough signatures and everything is valid?
Sure. So the statutes actually outline what has to be on a nomination paper. So people get to sign a nomination paper to say that they're asking or supporting that candidate being on the ballot. And so there's certain columns that we have to look for on those papers to make sure that the candidate collected the right information from voters. Things like the voter's name, their address, if they're specific districts, we have to make sure that they live within that district where the candidate is running. And then there can also be challenges. So candidates have an opportunity to challenge each other's papers. And if there are insufficiencies, then again, the commission has to consider those for ballot access.
We're talking about the 2020 elections with Megan Wolf, the administrator of Wisconsin State Elections Agency. What questions do you have about voting in elections? What questions do you have about voter registration or voting with absentee ballots? What do you want to see done in terms of election security this year? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. You mentioned My Vote and the website. I went there last week, Friday, just to see what it looks like and what information I can learn. How quickly do people need to register to vote if they're not registered already?
So here in the state of Wisconsin, there are a lot of opportunities to register to vote. One is you can register to vote online if you have a Wisconsin DMV product. So if you have a Wisconsin driver license or a state ID card that's current and valid, you can actually register online up until 20 days before the date of an election. You can also register to vote in that same time period by mail as well. If you register by mail, you're going to have to send something called a proof of residence document. This is something with your name and your current address that proves where you live. You can also, after that 20 days, so within the 20-day window before an election, you can register in person in your municipal clerk's office. So your city, your town, your village office, you can go in person and register there. You're going to have to show them that proof of residence document. So if, let's say, your Wisconsin driver license or state ID card has your current address on it, you can use that. If it doesn't have your current address on it, you can use something like a utility bill, a bank statement, and you can even show those electronically to your clerk as well. And then, of course, we also have same-day registration here in Wisconsin. So you can register at your polling place on election day. Again, remember, if your name or your address is changed or you're a first-time Wisconsin voter, if you're going to register at the polls on election day, bring that proof of residence document with you. So again, if your driver license or your state ID card does not have your current address on it for registration purposes, that's okay. Bring something else with you, like a utility bill, a bank statement, a lease, something that shows your current address on it.
Well, let's take a call now. Chris is joining us from Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. I'm hearing all of these things and all of these restrictions and all of the hoops that you have to go through in order to be able to vote. And I need to understand why one person voting two times is enough to set the entire state on fire, but stopping thousands and thousands and tens of thousands of people from voting is just fine. This is something I can't understand.
Chris,
Chris,
thanks for the call. How big of an impact is voter fraud?
So after every general election, we have to submit a report. So basically what we do is we take a look at the voter rolls and we analyze if there are duplications in terms of participation. And then we submit those reports. We work with the local election official to make sure that they're referred to the district attorney. And we also have to submit a report to the legislature, too, on anything findings that there are. And typically that number is very low. I believe after the 2018 election, it was around 20 to 24 referrals that were made. In terms of people that maybe registered incorrectly, or there were duplications, or there was just information out there. And so it is a very low percentage in terms of people that we end up finding, but technology does aid us a lot in being able to analyze after the election if there are any actions that we need to take.
And after those two dozen filings, what happens? Is there any, you know, we've identified some 24 irregularities, then what?
So those are referred to the district attorneys then, okay, to take a look at those, do further investigations, and figure out what the law enforcement piece of that's going to be. So our job is to find the information, collect the information, and then we pass it on to law enforcement to act upon.
So a month after the presidential primary, on May 12th, Governor Evers scheduled a special election to finalize the 7th congressional district. How much extra does it cost to have a special election on its own day?
So that really does depend on when the election is held. So as you mentioned, the election in the 7th congressional, the primary, is being held at the same time as that potentially statewide primary on February 18th. Mm-hmm. But then there will be that special election. And so it depends on the municipality. Each municipality is the one that's in charge of funding, staffing that election. And so even if it's a low turnout election, they still have to recruit poll workers, make sure that their voting equipment is programmed, and all the front and back end processes. So it really does depend. And it does depend on each municipality.
We have Megan Wolf, the administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, with us as we look ahead at preparations for upcoming election dates and the commission and the work it does. We're at 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kedar Chirkent. We're talking about 2020 election preparations. We're talking about security issues. In order to vote, you must be registered. The voter rolls is a big issue right now. You can check whether you're registered or whether you've been sent a moving letter on the My Vote Wisconsin website. If state election officials sent you a letter because you may have moved, that will be noted on your voter information page on the My Vote site. So what questions do you have about voter registration or voting with absentee ballots? What do you want to see done in terms of election security? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. The administrator of the Wisconsin Elections Commission, Megan Wolf, stays with us. So, Megan, there's been a lot of attention in recent weeks on this lawsuit seeking to remove more than 200,000 voters from registration rolls. And you have declined to talk about that case because it is pending litigation. But can you tell us how voters can check their registration status ahead of elections?
Sure. So the most important thing that voters need to know is that you have to be registered at your current address. So the law says, currently court decisions say that if you've resided at your address for at least 10 days with no current intent to move, then you can register to vote from that address. So if you have moved, just make sure that you're registered at your current address. And you can check your record on myvote.wi.gov. And there you'll be able to see where you're currently registered. And if you need to change your address, so if you have moved, you can register to vote at that new address right online up until 20 days before the election. And again, or you can go into your municipal clerk's office before the election, or you can register to vote on election day. Just make sure that you're going to the polling place for your new address. So you can actually go to the My Vote site too and plug in that new address and make sure that you're headed to the right polling place on election day.
Absentee ballots have become a lot more common in the last decade. How has that changed how clerks and other agencies prepare for elections?
Absentee balloting has really increased in the last few years, and it does mean that for your clerk, there's a lot more work that has to happen still on election day in terms of processing those ballots. So a lot of people don't know that every single absentee ballot is counted. There's rumors sometimes that you wait and see if the totals are close to count those ballots, but that's not true. All the absentee ballots are counted on election day. So when you cast your ballot by mail or in person in your municipal clerk's office, those ballots are actually counted on election day at your polling place. So it's an interesting process and one that voters can actually observe. Like almost everything in elections, voters have an opportunity to watch that process and watch those ballots be tallied.
Do you know how often people now file absentee ballots?
It really depends on the community. So okay. In some communities, the in-person absentee, so going into your clerk's office and casting a ballot before election day, is really popular. In other communities, you might see more by-mail absentee voting as well. And so it really depends on the community. There are some communities where going in person on election day is still the most prevalent option.
Well, let's take another call now. Tom is joining us from Middleton. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning.
What's on your mind?
Good morning.
Yeah, go ahead.
I wanted to ask Megan to reassure the public that there are now procedures in place to back up all electronic voting machines with paper so as to be able to conduct random audits to assure that the electronic voting machines in our state are not being hacked. I understand that those protections have been in place. And secondly, I wanted to ask Megan to point out that Wisconsin Statute Section 12.05 makes it a crime in Wisconsin to make or publish a false political ad or lie about a candidate or a referendum.
Well, let's take part one here, paper ballots. What is the status of them?
So in the state of Wisconsin, every single ballot cast has a paper auditable trail. And that's actually required by statute and has been for quite some time. So every single ballot cast here in the state of Wisconsin has a paper trail. There's two types of voting equipment that are in use. One is where you're going to mark that actual paper ballot and feed it through an optical scan tabulator. And 85% of the ballots cast in Wisconsin are cast using that method. And then there's another about 10% of ballots cast in Wisconsin system that are used what's called a DRE. And that's where you make the decisions on the screen. So you actually mark on the screen, a touch screen, who you'd like to vote for. But you're going to see a paper trail where you can actually verify that what you marked on the screen is actually how your ballot was cast as well. And then another 5% of ballots here in the state of Wisconsin are just cast on paper. They actually don't have electronic tabulation in some of the smaller communities, and that's allowed by statute. And I should also point out that we have a couple of audits as well as certifications that are built into the system. So every piece of voting equipment certified here for the state of Wisconsin to use by a municipality has to be certified at the federal and the state level. There are also tests and audits prior to every election done on every piece of voting equipment. So every piece of voting equipment is tested in public prior to each election here in the state. And after each general election, there are about 300 pieces of voting equipment, or about 5%, that are randomly selected after the election has completed to be hand counted, basically. So we do an audit of those machines to make sure that the machine total is the same as the paper tally is as well.
We are talking about the 2020 elections with Megan Wolf, Administrator of Wisconsin State Elections Agency. With your questions along the way on election security, 800-642-1234. Megan, when you last came on our program, the Elections Commission was working to replace outdated equipment and software being used by local election officials. What is the status of equipment and software upgrades?
We've been able to make a lot of progress. So one of the things that we did is work with our local election officials to offer a grant that they can utilize to purchase a new computer, to purchase IT support, and to attend training. And a lot of our local election officials did choose to opt for that grant, and they're now in a much more secure position. And so we continue to partner with our local election officials to make sure that they have the resources that they need to run elections securely. But, you know, we have those local election officials, and we make sure that they have what they need, but we're also there at the state and the federal level, making sure that they have that cybersecurity expertise at a larger scale to protect the overall system and infrastructure.
Yeah, because across the country, government agencies and private businesses have reported cases where hackers took control of important systems and then demanded ransom money. Have you seen any of this type of case happening in Wisconsin?
Ransomware, phishing attacks, things like that happen at the state and local level every single day. We have not seen anything targeted specifically at elections, but we continue to work with our local election officials to educate them about these possibilities and to make sure that they have a plan in place and that we practice that plan about what would happen if we did have some kind of a cyber incident and how would we respond together. Who would the players be in making sure that we responded quickly and that there was no impact on the election?
Taking another call now, Chris in Green Bay is with us. Hi, Chris.
Good morning. Thank you. I'm wondering, or just curious, how do residents in Wisconsin who are either in transition between homes or homeless vote?
Sure. So there's a couple of different options. One is if you are homeless and you don't have a fixed address, the law actually allows you to use as proof of residence some kind of letter from a social service agency that shows where you usually accept your mail or reside for voting purposes. So there are allowances. There's actually a little map if you look at the voter registration form. So if somebody doesn't have a traditional address, they're able to actually mark on a map where their usual residence is for voting purposes. And then again, they can provide some kind of letter from a social service agency. There's also in our law what's called intent to return. This might be for someone that maybe is away from their normal place of residence for a temporary purpose but intends to return to that former address. They can continue to vote from that former address. And then again, there's the residency requirement in the law. So if you have not lived at your current address for 10 days on the date of the election, you can continue to vote from your former address until you achieve residency at that new address.
How closely do you work right now with federal authorities like the Department of Homeland Security to monitor threats coming into Wisconsin's election systems?
Very closely. Every day I talk to state and federal partners in the intelligence community, in the cybersecurity community, to make sure that we have the information that we need to protect elections here in the state of Wisconsin. So we have regular what we call tabletop exercises where we practice with our state and federal partners how we would respond. We've been very fortunate that we haven't had to actually execute these plans in a real life situation, but we're ready, we're prepared, and we've been practicing how we would respond if there were a bad day in elections.
As we wrap up here, 2020 census happening this year. Lawmakers will ultimately use the new population estimates to reshape our election districts. Is the commission doing anything this year to prepare for that process?
So our role in redistricting is really just to accept those files once they're determined by the legislatures and passed on to us. We don't play a role in actually drawing those lines. That being said, Wisconsin voters should know that we're very well prepared and we're really ahead of the curve when it comes to things like GIS and geocoding technology within our statewide system. So what this means is once we do get new lines, we'll be able to more easily accept those new boundaries into the system and make sure that voters are getting the right ballot, because your address determines that what ballot you get. Where you're registered to vote determines who you're eligible to vote for, who represents you. And so that's really important to make sure that that's right. And our system is built in order to have the most accuracy that you can have during that process.
Megan, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Megan Wolf is administrator of the State Elections Commission. Coming up, we talk with Republican State Representative John Mocco from the northeastern part of the state. Do you live in Green Bay or nearby? What do you think state lawmakers should know? What challenges do you want them addressing in your community? Join in 800-642-1234. State Cap continues after this news update here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is the State Capitol Report on a Monday. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Customary to the state cap, we like to hear from lawmakers, and we're going to talk about a package of bills addressing elder abuse, spearheaded by Republican State Representative John Mocco. The U.S. Department of Justice has identified elder abuse as an issue that will become more prevalent as baby boomers age. So what questions do you have for Republican State Representative John Mocco? Do you support harsher penalties for people who commit elder abuse? We're at 800-642-1234. State Representative John Mocco of Ledgeview represents part of Green Bay and its surrounding communities, including De Pere. Voters have reelected him to the State Assembly since 2014, and he joins us from our studios in Green Bay this morning. Representative Mocco, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. Thanks for having us. We're celebrating our victory here.
I still can feel the vibes through the microphone. So elder abuse cases present in different ways. There could be neglect or financial exploitation, yep. Emotional, physical abuse. Before we get into what these bills do, why are you putting such a legislative focus behind this issue?
So, yep, that's great. Let's start from the beginning. So, unfortunately, my mother-in-law was a victim of financial abuse, and it was staggering to me when we ran into the problem several years ago as to what some of the things were. So, we initially came out with some bills, and I originally called them Doris's Law, named after her, and realized it's a more in-depth conversation than I had even began to imagine. And I think we have to also understand the demographics. We've got right now the 72 million of us baby boomers that were born between 1945 and 1965 are starting to turn 70. We're retiring at the rate of 10,000 a day. In the next 15 years, fully 24% of the population here in the state of Wisconsin will be in their mid-80s. When you couple that with the fact that women outlive men, the vast majority of that will be women. And then when you also look at where wealth is concentrated, it's generally concentrated in retirees. So that means a lot of women in their 80s that have assets. And so we hear of many different types of abuse, one that we experienced. And so it became personal to me. What we then realized was, as I had a consultation with the Chief Justice of the Wisconsin Supreme Court. Are these some things that we can do? Then we sat down with the Attorney General. What can we need to do? And from those conversations, we realized it's a bigger problem than we had thought, and it requires a little more thought. So we created a special task force, the Attorney General's special task force, where we brought in all kinds of interested parties from banking and finance and social services, many, many different organizations to flesh out the conversation. And as a result, we came up with these four bills at this time.
Yeah, and you introduced this package with State Senator Patrick Teston.
Correct.
One bill passed committee stage in December. Three more bills took that step last Thursday. Mm-hmm. So let's start with the December bill, which would require courts to ensure speedy trials in cases that involve elderly victims or witnesses. Why do you support this particular piece of legislation to speed up the trial process?
Well, we had to pick an age. So I'm 61, so I don't consider myself a special needing any special care. But you have to pick an age. And in labor law, it's 50. So you're protected class at 50. In this case, you're a protected class at 60 or disabled. And a lot of times those folks, and particularly in my mother-in-law's case, you're just physically not able to have a program that's dragged out or a process that's dragged out indefinitely. And you probably also have some medical needs that need to be met. So we need to make sure that those assets are secured to provide that.
The legislation would also allow courts to record testimony from elderly people and then have that testimony admitted as evidence in trials. Why should the courts allow recorded testimony from elderly victims?
Well, again, the ex parte information is more valuable in that case because many of these people are not ambulatory. And so we don't want to exacerbate the victim by mandating. We wanted to make it as easy for them to get their information to the courts.
Could recorded testimony, though, leave criminal defendants at an unfair disadvantage since they won't be able to cross-examine these witnesses?
Well, and that's a good point. So I think it's important to back up just a moment and realize that there's four bills. There's 479, 480, 481, and 482. And so some of these things, there are two of those bills talk about the criminal proceedings that you're talking about and rules and regulations that we're asking now the courts to follow. And then one drives financial service providers, one banks and one brokerage firms. So the four bills do different things, and one of those things does allow for cross-examination.
Representative, may I ask about financial exploitation? How big of an issue is it, and how did your mother-in-law fare?
Yeah. Well, and I'll have to say I'm a little bit disappointed. I mean, anytime you get into a program as big as this, and my wife just asked me this morning, she said, well, we're missing some pieces here. And we are missing some pieces. And so a lot of times what the legislature does is we tweak and fix things that need to be tweaked and fixed. And sometimes it's a simple thing, like if we change the word from shale to may or may to shale. In this case, it's a whole bunch of new legislation. And so there are some things that we think that I think we'll need to do to enhance. One piece, for example, is we don't have any new procedures to attorneys. And in our case, that was the problem. And so certainly we want to be able to address issues where we all hear about the phone call where the person calls and they hoodwink a vulnerable person into transferring $1,000 or $10,000.
Yeah.
But when you have family members or caregivers that have access to these things and they change powers of attorney or beneficiary designations, they can move entire estates over to people that may not have been intended to have that. And so a lot of this is designed for that.
We're discussing a package of legislation aimed at curbing elder abuse with John Mocco. He's a Republican representative from Ledgeview. Are you trying to stop elder abuse in your community or in your family? What are you doing? Have you or your family been affected by elder abuse? What can you tell us about your experience? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. So, Representative, another bill in the package would increase criminal penalties and create a new crime, physical abuse of an elder person that is right. Modeled after existing child abuse laws. Why are stiffer penalties needed to stop elder abuse in this area?
Because it's particularly heinous. And so as we look at it, it's much like child abuse. So that's what we've base these on is so certain child abuse issues now would also apply to elder abuse issues. And I should also mention to you that Representative Mike Rorcast had done a special task force on Alzheimer's and dementia and went all around the state and took testimony. And I want to tell you, it was heart-wrenching to hear of some of the issues, not just in the financial area that we were dealing with, but on the sexual assault issues as well. And so it's profoundly heart-wrenching to hear some of those cases. So what happens is any sexual act of misconduct is currently a second-degree sexual assault. It moves to a first-degree sexual assault if the victim is 60 years or older. And it escalates a sexual assault crime from a Class C to a Class B felony if the victim is 60 years or older. And that's whether the perpetrator knows the victim's age or not.
Wisconsin's prison population is growing. Governor Evers campaigned on this pledge to dramatically reduce the prison population. Has the state, in your opinion, exhausted other options to fight elder abuse that don't involve more prison time?
I think you see them in here. You know, as far as fines and penalties are concerned, freezing assets, those types of things. So, yeah, we have, I think.
Rather than spend tax dollars keeping people in prisons for a longer time, would that money be better spent on treatment or supervision that keeps people in their communities and working and receiving social support?
Well, probably, and I think if you look at, I don't have that information here, you know, I think that dovetails perfectly with the mental health packages that we're trying to get put together.
Let's go to Marcus now in Milwaukee with thoughts on this. Hi, Marcus.
Good morning. So my parents are getting up there in age, and I guess my question is, what would be your best recommendation to set up for executor and power of attorney, health power of attorney and things like that to try and combat some of this perhaps on the front end?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think probably the best thing that advisors can do, and I think I just for full disclosure, one of the companies that we founded was the Michael Financial Group. So we do financial planning and asset management clients in 18 different states. And so I can speak to that. And I think the number one thing that your folks should do is when they get all of those powers taken care of and they get all of that stuff is to give the children or whoever's going to be having, give them the actual hard copies. I think too oftentimes the parents get that all put together and they were taught you never talk about finance or politics or religion, and so they don't. And then you've got to track those documents down when all of a sudden you realize, and because these things don't happen instantaneously. These are slow things, and all of a sudden dad's forgetting a little bit, and then maybe he can't drive, and then maybe he's forgetting his meds. And the next thing you know, you're in that situation. And so to have all of those powers, I would suggest that how many ever siblings there are, that the folks that are involved actually have actionable documents. So when they do need to take action, they can, and they have the originals. And this is what happens a lot and happened in our case, is that the documents that mom and dad put together for 35, 40 years with their bankers, their financial people, their brokerage firms, their everything, and we're not talking about a lot of money here. Those are all set up. That's all teed up for 35 or 40 years. And then all of a sudden, somebody else comes along and changes all of those powers of attorney and makes themselves in charge of it all. And that's the issue.
You have a line to Representative John Mocco of Ledgeview in the northeastern part of the state. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you support lawmakers passing a tax cut this year? Which taxes do you think they should reduce? Are income taxes or property taxes too high? Be part of the discussion, 800-642-1234. Back with more State Cap in just a moment here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report on a Monday. Thanks for being here. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The State Assembly's committee work is well underway this month. Republican Representative John Mocco chairs the Committee on Ways and Means. He sits on seven committees in all. On the issue of taxes, would you rather see lawmakers spend more tax dollars on services rather than approving a tax cut? Which public services do you think need more funding in Wisconsin? What questions do you have for Representative Mocco? You have a line to the lawmaker, 800-642-1234. You can tweet us, WPR Mornings. Representative, before we move on to taxes, for the elder abuse cases, after passing committee, do you expect the package of bills on elder abuse to be approved by the full assembly and then the Senate?
So that's a great question. So the bills have passed the assembly committee process. Senator Dave Craig assures me that he will be hearing those and pushing those out through his committee in about 2 weeks, and then they need to be brought to the floor. So I fully expect that they will be put out, every single person on the committee, Republican or Democrat. And I think it's important to realize that these passed committee nearly unanimously. I think we had one dissenting vote for some technical thing. But they passed unanimously on both Republicans and Democrats, and every person, even during the hearing last week, had a heart-wrenching story before they cast their vote about how important these are. So I do believe they'll pass the House, and then I believe Mr. Craig will see that they get through the Senate, and it is my hope then that the governor does sign them.
Yeah, how does the governor feel about this package? Do you know?
Again, keep in mind this has been going on for about 2.5 years, so I've not had a direct conversation with this governor on this particular issue. But I think, again, when we talk to legislative leadership and the fact that they are bipartisan, I think he'll I'm hoping that he signs them.
You chair the Assembly Ways and Means Committee, which reviews a lot of tax-related legislation.
Yep.
What are some of your top priorities for modifying state tax laws?
Right. So Ways and Means is essentially the ways and means of financing the state of Wisconsin. And although we're not the same power and the same control that, let's say, the federal Ways and Means do, we are the busiest committee in the House. We are processing, I think, somewhere upwards of 60 different tax bills. By contrast, most committees will have 7. So we're quite busy with it. We're very, very fortunate. I think we'll find in the next week or so that the Fiscal Bureau will come out with an additional report saying that we're running a surplus again here in the state of Wisconsin. So we have a really well-run organization, and some of the problems that plague the federal policy doesn't plague us. And so, for example, our budgets over the last 10 years have increased by 20%. And that's significant. Our budget this last year, biannual budget, was over $80 billion. And so we've gone up substantially. Every single department, contrary to what some folks might think, every single department has gotten increases year after year after year, and certainly not as much as some people would think. I don't think there's ever enough to satisfy everybody, but every department has gotten an increase over the last 10 years, and our total spending in the state of Wisconsin is up 20%. And in doing that, we've also funded our rainy day fund. There's almost two-thirds of $1 billion sitting there for emergencies, and we've reduced debt. We have literally $1 billion less debt this year than we had 8 years ago, which saves us about $4 million a week, $200 million a year in debt service. So we're moving forward. When that happens, when you're doing that, when every department's getting an increase, we're paying off debt, we're putting money in the savings account, and then you still have excess cash, I believe that's excess taxation and needs to be returned. So we did two pieces of legislation this past year that passed our committee and then eventually were signed by the governor. One was a big $500 million income tax reduction. So people will see that in the first two brackets, their actual tax rates go down to $500 million. That was first vetoed by the governor, but then included in the budget, and he paid that. And the second piece was part of this new what we call a marketplace facilitator taxation. And we knew that was going to generate additional revenue, and we didn't want it to be an extra burden for the citizens, so we wanted it to offset other things. So we have it offset income tax, and that took effect the first of this year. So those are two pieces, about $560 million.
Okay.
altogether. And if we have some additional here, I would hope that we would use that again to continue to reduce the burden.
Well, we've seen Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald and Speaker Robin Voss have both voiced interest in passing a tax cut this session. What kind of income tax cut could you support and also see getting through into law by Governor Evers?
So that's a great question. And I'm not sure. When you say income tax, I would like to do it again. I think it'd be fantastic just to eliminate the entire first bracket. I don't think we'll have the amount of revenue to do that, but I would continue to drive it and model it after what South Carolina has done, what South Dakota has done, what Utah has done, other good, because those are the states that we're competing against. And so I think we've got an opportunity to fix the tax code. However, you know, property tax is also a disproportionate part in the state of Wisconsin. Unfortunately, as you know, the state does not levy property tax. Property tax is levied by local communities. So it's a little frustrating. It's a little less direct for us to provide statewide property tax relief because we're not actually the people levying it. It's the school districts, it's the technical schools in the cities and the municipalities. But those are some of the conversations. But I got to tell you, Kate, if we're going to have an argument in the legislature on where to cut the tax, I think that's a great conversation to have. I don't care where we cut it as long as we cut it.
We're discussing state politics and legislation with John Mocco, a Republican representative from Ledgeview. You can join in 800-642-1234. Let's look at dark stores. You support legislation with broad bipartisan support that would close the so-called dark store loophole, which retailers have used to lower their property taxes. Retailers say their property tax assessments should be based on the value of empty dark stores. We saw last week Governor Evers called this legislation a top priority. What do you see here?
I think it's, you know, as in all of these things, whether it was the first piece that we talked about with elder care issues, whether it's any, you know, the tax issue, is that the devil is in the details. And so there were two people that got smacked around for trying to do dark stores a couple years ago. And one of those guys was me because we held an 11-hour hearing on the dark store issue. And there are some folks that did not appreciate that. And that's fine. I do think we need to have a tax code that's fair, low and simple. And that includes for everybody. But there's two parts of the dark store thing. One is the lease conversation on how valuations are done, and then one is just the real estate valuation component. And I don't see that happening now because we just haven't worked out the details.
But shouldn't we be concerned as more and more brick-and-mortar stores are going out of business? I was in a mall yesterday, and I was appalled to see how many stores were closing.
But that has nothing to do with property tax.
So do you...
A lot about retailing, and that's what the problem is with that.
Do you expect any changes to the proposed legislation to accommodate concerns from retailers that they would be unfairly taxed?
I do think we have to close the dark store loopholes, but that's, again, a general broad term, and it's not a single loophole. It's not two loopholes. It's how towns and municipalities are assessing property and how valuations are done.
Very quickly here, as we wrap up, you've called improving Interstate 41 in the northeastern part of the state a top priority. In the state budget, lawmakers approved 23 miles of expansion.
Right. Yep.
Will the approved expansion be enough to address your concerns?
Well, again, it's hard for us to get ahead of capacity expansion. So I think the road repair component is one conversation on the transportation budget. And then capacity expansion is another. And we absolutely have to do that. We need that Southern Bridge. I've been advocating for the Southern Bridge for the last 5 years since I've been elected. So those are all good starts. Now, keep in mind, that doesn't give us the Southern Bridge. That just gives us an expansion of 41 and an off-ramp. And then we still have to get the bridge part done. So there's 9 pieces to that project. So, again, a little more complicated than people think. But I think it would be fantastic to have a southern beltway that would tie Packerland on the far west side all the way through a southern bridge and then go on. I mean, that road by Foth and Van Dyke is called Southern Bridge Road. For the love of Pete, we've been wanting to do this for 30 years. I think it's time we get that done.
Well, Representative, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks. Time went fast.
John Mocco is a Republican state representative from Ledgeview in the northeastern part of the state. He represents part of Green Bay and its surrounding communities, including De Pere. And he joined us from our WPR studios in Green Bay. Just ahead, we spend the hour exploring the challenges of our state's dairy industry after another major producer declared bankruptcy. We look at supply chain and what's facing farmers. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.